Okay, if you remember in the last lecture, I was talking about global grids and coordinate referencing systems, and I mentioned that we could refer, or a grid system could be any system which allows us to refer to, oh, it's so great to have this mic finally, be able to walk around, to any system that allows us to put a geocode or a reference, a geographic reference onto a location and arrive at a single point. We looked at some of the grid systems that allows us to support different resolutions, 100 kilometers, a kilometer, 1 meter, 10 meters, whatever. Today I want to look at the same site, kind of idea, but different types of units, irregular units. And we'll look at one more coordinate system, the United States Public Land Survey System, which is sort of not really a coordinate system at all, but it gets used for it in some respects. Okay, but I'm going to consider this generally in terms of land partitioning systems and parcels. And parcels are what you show on what are called cadastral maps that allow us to show primarily land ownership and property. So the grid systems that we saw could refer to areas. Most of those areas we looked at in the grid systems on Wednesday were rectangular or square areas. But they can also be irregular areas, and they can describe these as well as points. Some good examples, zip codes. There's the zip code map of parts of Santa Barbara County, police districts. You probably noticed Isla Vista has its own police district. Census enumeration districts and census tracts, which have just been in the public eye because of the 2010 census. Probably the most detailed one I'm going to go over today, land ownership parcels, or what's called the cadastre. Cadastral mapping is the mapping that deals with specifying the ownership description of who owns what piece of land. So it deals very much with how humans relate to the land surface. There are many others. You know, cities. I just found out a few weeks ago the city boundary of Santa Barbara along my street actually includes my house and then dips back a little bit and then includes a couple more houses and dips back a little bit. Really, it's kind of arbitrary which houses are included and which are not. Neighborhoods and districts, sometimes these are formally specified and have meaningful names. Sometimes they're more colloquial. They have names that we just give to neighborhoods and we kind of don't really know or understand where the neighborhood is, like downtown Santa Barbara. We don't really know where it begins or ends. And then there are systems that are based on entire nations that can indeed have variable resolution. And there are good examples for Canada, for some countries in Europe and the United Kingdom, but I'm going to concentrate on the United States today, hence the Al Frankel thing. Okay. If we take the cadastral layer up, that's the land, the principal layer that controls land ownership in this country, and here I've just draped it over Google Earth for part of Orange County, you can see that parts of it look nice and ordered. That has lots of squares as part of it, and those squares fall under the United States Public Land Survey System. And then things get very fragmented down here for a bit. And even within the grid system, you can see that the squares don't even line up very well as we go from one side to the other. So these idiosyncrasies is really the interesting part of the history that I want to talk about today. So let's go back and do a little bit of history first, and let's look at the history of land ownership. We didn't really bother about land ownership until we started inventing engineering projects on a large scale, building roads, putting up large-scale buildings, temples, and so forth. And the first people to systematically create a system for surveying and for partitioning land ownership that they extended over their entire empire were the ancient Romans. Probably predates them by a long way. It goes back at least to ancient Egypt. But the Romans really got it down pat, invented surveying equipment to go along with it, and some of those ideas from their surveying techniques still survive today. So if we go to the sort of heartland of the Roman Empire, the breadbasket of Rome, the Po Valley in northern Italy, and let's just look at a couple of regions. Here's an agricultural region within the Po Valley. It's still today laid out exactly the way it was for the fields in the Roman times. They called this system centuriation, because it was on the basis of dividing things up by hundreds. And this was an era that favored long, narrow plots that could be farmed by individual families or one individual human, and because they usually used the ox or horse to draw a plow the length of it, so long stretches without turning became very important. Notice the roads, a straight They're parallel with each other, and they divide up north, south, and east, west. So this idea of using grid systems for partitioning the land is very prevalent. And it's imprinted on the landscape in lots of different places. Here's a picture I took when I was in Verona while I was on sabbatical. And you can be walking around the medieval city, you know, with windy little streets and alleys and plazas and so on. Then all of a sudden you come to a street and it's straight as an arrow, dead straight line. Okay, so something has imposed order, and I would argue that imposed the survey line of centuriation onto a city as the city grew up into the rural area. Now, that's not the way things got started here in the United States. We didn't have a grid system to begin with as far as land ownership is concerned. Almost all of the original 13 colonies and many more, all parts of the eastern United States, were originally surveyed using a technique they inherited from the British called metes and bounds. Okay, there's metes and bounds up there. And metes and bounds was sort of practical because there weren't too many professionals who could go out and survey the land at this time. Metes and bounds was very heavily dependent upon the existence of this kind of a map that was an initial property description, but it ultimately depended upon the idea that two adjacent landowners, usually farmers, would agree to meet once a year and walk along their common boundary and agree exactly where it was. Okay, so you had to sort of pass down by narrative history the property ownership boundaries from one year to another. And as you know, you can often have disputes if you disagree over land ownership, even by a matter of inches. What exactly does this mean? What is a meets and bounds? Well, this is a legal meets and bounds description by the earliest times, by colonial times. Even the first several presidents were all licensed surveyors. They were all able to survey land using these techniques. And, you know, right up there's a 1929 view of a bunch of surveyors with their rods and poles and transits and compasses ready to be able to survey a meets and bounds type survey. So this is an actual property description. This is from Mercer County, Kentucky. It's out of deed book number 7, page 417 in their historical records. And it records on the 13th of February, 1810, when Rice Beetles of Lincoln County, Kentucky is selling 140 acres and 36 poles of land, I assume that's square poles, of land in Mercer County on Doctor's Fork to John Crane for £200. We weren't even using dollars at that time, in this part at least. And the land is bounded as follows. Beginning at the mouth of a branch, at an ash stump, thence up the creek, south 20, that's a compass bearing, 20 degrees off of south, to two beech trees, okay. Thence east, 41 poles, to a small walnut in Ulnitz line. Thence north, etc., etc. You get the whole idea. And then at the end, 223 poles back to the beginning. So this is describing starting at one point and doing what we would now call a traverse, going off at an angle, turning to another angle, walking a particular distance until you arrive back at the starting point. Anybody see a fundamental flaw with this property description from day one? Yeah. Right. A lot of these trees have now disappeared. Even one was a stump. That's already rotting away, right? I'm aware of one geographer at University of Michigan, Dan Brown, who actually went back and looked at all these original surveys and saw what trees were being identified and then used that to do an inventory of what trees were growing there before it was cleared by the farmland, or to be farmland. So this is not pegged to anything permanent on the landscape, and therefore it's very spurious. It's easy to make mistakes with a meets and bounds type property description. But we still use it today. We have a little better, more accurate surveying instruments now for fixing the locations of things, but here's, you know, somebody selling land, in this case on Route 66 in Virginia, just a map that was convenient on the web. But as you can see, there's still just arbitrarily partitioning things off. Here's a wiggle in this property boundary for no particular reason. Usually they're trying to give so many acres to each person in this case. And the means of surveying, it was probably somebody standing out there with survey instruments, pounding stakes into the ground. If you've noticed, the campus is currently being marked up for the infrastructure project that's about to begin. And the first thing that's appeared is, you know, they've marked little chip marks on the edges of all the concrete blocks, have spray painted it directions all over the place, and stuck a lot of wooden stakes in the ground. So this is still very much the way that land is partitioned up. Now, when we take that on a grand scale, the whole country was partitioned up. Once we get beyond the meets and bounds states, and if we look at here, we've got meets and bounds states in mostly in the original colonies, plus a little bit more here, so all the East Coast really falls into meets and bounds definitions. Texas, a little bit of an exception here. But if you fly across the country and look down, you know, I can always tell when if I'm coming past here, when I cross the Mississippi River, because all I need to do is look at the fields, and the field boundary, and see whether I'm in a meets and bounds state or whether I'm in a township and range public land survey state. Okay. So the beginning of the system, and this goes right the way back to the start of the country, founding fathers, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, all these people, when they decide that we're going to open up the whole country, or rather the whole continent to be settled as part of the United States, decides that it needs to be rationally surveyed. Why? Because the founding fathers believed that the states should be approximately equal in size, so they evenly distributed the resources across the country. Now, if that's the case, you could argue, why do we have Texas, which is so huge? And why do we have California, which was so huge? Well, just by historical accidents, they were originally republics before they joined the Union. So they'd already set their boundaries before they became part of the United States. But this explains why we have many exact, you know, latitude, longitude blocks, states in the middle of the country in such a way that they were designed to be pretty much the same size. If you want to get into the history of this, I recommend a book called How the Shapes Got Their States, which is some good YouTube interviews and videos about that, if you want to get a first look. So what do we do? Well, the government in Washington decides that the first thing we need to do is get a bunch of people who know and understand how to survey, both astronomically and on the ground, and we'd better pick a few places that are going to be standardized. So we're going to pick what are called a series of meridians, principal meridians that are going to be measured off across the country. Originally, they're just going to be numbered as we go across the country, progressively west. And then those are going to be used as the reference points for starting up survey systems. So let's pick one arbitrarily. This is in Illinois. This is actually the marker stone, what's called a witness corner, for the origins of their survey system. So this is the intersection of the baseline, which was a line parallel, a line that was running east-west, and the principal meridian. In this case, it was the third principal meridian of the United States Public Land Survey System as we were moving from east to west. So this is a commemorative one put down by the Surveyors Association. It gives you the exact location of where it is. But you can see pretty much exactly what's being done here. We've established a reference point, we've established a parallel, and we've measured this off using astronomical observations, and then we've established a principal meridian, which is going to be the basis for things. They also call this centralia. A lot of place names got started like this. How many places can you think of that have a meridian road, for example? Now, before this got started, there was a sort of experimental state where they tried to work it out beforehand, and that was Ohio. And Ohio is, to put it quite simply, it's a mess. I mean, it's got at least the sort of first fits and starts of about 9 different survey systems that were started and then abandoned, but eventually found their way into the system. Why? Well, because the states disagreed about who should have Ohio. For one thing, the Western Reserve of Ohio was originally part of Connecticut. And that was an interesting historical argument between New York State and Connecticut. Connecticut argued that its territory extended from the East Coast all the way across to the West Coast, whole way across the country. So they decided to skip New York and start claiming land beyond it. And the first thing they claimed was the Western Reserve. You probably have heard about Case Western University in Ohio, that's within this property. All sorts of other disputes. That little strip up there called the Toledo Strip was originally disputed by Michigan. It's supposedly the source of the rivalry between Michigan and Ohio. Various other baselines, one established in 1819, another one here in 1799, another separate territory out here. basically lots of different military surveys. So we end up with, you might call, Ohio was the very messy prototype for the public land survey system. I could give you a whole lecture just on Ohio, but I'm not going to. So what happens when we go from a state that has at least begun a rectangular survey from one that's in meets and bounds? Well, I just zoomed in here on the National Map Viewer and turned on the public ownership data, the land ownership information, the public land survey, and you'll see that it's quite well detailed out here in Ohio. In fact, we've got both townships and ranges. I'll define those for you in just a second. And then the lines continue just for sort of completeness sake when we cross over the border into West Virginia. And then West Virginia proper, it doesn't have any meaning whatsoever. The township range doesn't mean anything because we're in a meets and bounds state, so it just disappears. And these kinds of boundaries are all over the place when you go looking for them. Let's hop the country and come all the way to California. There are three principal meridians within the state of California. The one closest to us is the San Bernardino meridian, and its original principal point was up here in the San Bernardino Mountains, Washington Mountain. It's permanently marked. There's the marker if you want to hike up and take a look. That single point of reference was the point of reference for the at least Southern California's survey systems. But of course it arrived and was established a long time after land partitioning began in the state of California. We had two others, Mount Diablo and then the Humboldt Meridian, which actually only got used for a little piece of the coast all the way up in the northern part of the state. Now, this idea of the township and range survey system is so embedded in our culture that it's there and we don't even know it. Remember, who was the guy? Eminem. Right? Did a thing about Eight Mile Road in Detroit, where the original marker line was on the south of the city. 8 Mile Road was the dividing line between northern limits of the city of Detroit and the remainder of the state, and became very much a social dividing line. It's 8 Mile Road because it's 8 miles from the geographer's line, from the baseline for the survey of the state of Michigan. Here we are in California, and we have a baseline road. We still call it baseline road. Lots of meridian roads and so on. They're all over the place once you start looking for them. So what do those lines mean? What are they referring to? This is how the system worked. And once it was decided upon, and once they got the bugs worked out in Ohio, they just stamped this pattern state by state, baseline by baseline across the entire United States. We begin with the principal meridian. And the baseline, that's like the origin point for our system. We usually got some kind of marker there, just like the one I showed you in San Bernardino. And then we start numbering ranges going west and east. So this is range 1 west, range 2 west, range 3 west, as far as we want to take it. Range 1 east, range 2 east, and so on, as far as we want to take it. The ranges size is 6 miles by 6 miles. That's a 6 mile by 6 mile block on the landscape. As we go north and south, okay, so as we go south of the baseline, we call this township 1 south, 2 south, 3 south, and so on. Township 1 north, 2 north, and so on. So I can talk about that block up there as township 2 north, range 2 east. And on the landscape, we can have range lines and township lines, and baselines and principal meridians, and so on. Now, 36 square mile block is quite a lot of land to be able to farm or even own. It's an enormous amount of territory. If you're going to assign one household to each farm, you want a smaller block. So how do we come up with smaller blocks? Well, we do this. We take each township and divide it up into 36 sections. And each section is given a number, and the numbering system is really wacky. It's called a boustrophedonic system, another word to amaze your friends with. Boustrophedonic literally means as the plow turns, or as the plow moves. So if we start with section number 1 in the upper right-hand corner, we go up to 6, and then we just turn down to 7 and go back again, down to 13 and back to 18, 19, back to 24, 25, and so on until we get back to 36. You notice that 36 is now adjacent to numbers that don't resemble it in any way whatsoever. So we couldn't have confusion here about which township we were in, which is a good idea. Each of these is 1 square mile, 640 acres. It can be divided up subsequently if we want to. But normally, as the land of the nation was being divided up, one of these sections was kept as public property. What today certain people might call socialism, right? And the goal was that the revenue from farming on that one section would be used to support public education, and it would be where the schoolhouse would be built to serve the entire community. This system became so prosperous, it funded more than elementary schools. It eventually founded entire university systems across the country called the land-grant colleges. Okay, so the land-grant universities, this was their origin. This is where the funding came from. 640 acres in some places is not too much land to farm. If it's rangeland, if it's fertile farmland, you probably want to cut it up a little bit more. And the divisions of farmland normally were done like this. You could have a quarter section at 160 acres. You could have a half of a quarter split vertically or horizontally, or you could have a quarter of a quarter. Okay, and this begins to get a little strange in the way we describe them. So you talk about this is the east half of the southeast quarter of section 23, range 14 north, sorry, range 14 west, township 7 north, something like that. Might be the full description of the piece of property. Quarter acre, we're beginning to get, you know, these are individual household sizes now, just a few, 40 acres or so, 40 acres and a what was it? 40 acres and a mule. That was what we promised everybody after the Civil War. Well, this pattern of land ownership and the way it was divided and subdivided through years of inheritance and so on to various farmers, and then was amalgamated as small farms became larger farms, is still embedded in much of the way the country looks in terms of agriculture. Certainly, if you fly over California's Central Valley and look down, or if you go anywhere over the Midwest of the United States and look down, you see a pattern that looks like this, and this is just screaming township and range at you. This is how the land has been divided up. It's how the roads have been built at the edges of the sections, so that they divide parcels owned by different people. And in this case, I can also tell you they're using center pivot irrigation. That's where all those circles are coming from. And they put a well in the middle, it pumps up water, and a big rotating thing that goes round and round dribbles the water down over on the landscape. That's how you get circular fields like this, or even semicircular fields or quarter circular fields if you run into those kinds of predicaments where you don't own all the land. So here's a parcel reference. This is the United States Public Land Survey System, but it's being used to give a reference to a piece of land. I actually pulled this off of a real estate database where they're selling land. So this piece of land is up for sale. I think it's in California. I can't remember where. Probably not anymore. I did this a year ago. And it's the northwest quarter of the southwest quarter of Section 3, Township 31 North, Range 79 West, on the 6th principal meridian. I think that's actually in... I looked it up this morning. I think it's in Kansas. May not be in Kansas. Can't remember. Just a couple of things to point out. Think about it. We went to the center point of the system, where the baseline or the geographer's line meets the principal meridian, and we started counting off townships and ranges east and west. This one's 31 townships north and 79 townships west. That's a long way away from its principal meridian. What are we forgetting about? Well, if we're just marking a square grid out on the landscape, lining things up by line of sight, eventually the Earth's going to curve away from us, and we're going to run into some problems with what we think are straight lines becoming curves. What do? Well, we fudge it, right? Generally speaking, as they were marking off large increments, large units, every several, every sixth or tenth, mark off that they did of a complete township, they would stop and resurvey and say, oh, we're off by 17 feet because of the Earth's curvature, so let's move all the lines over 17 feet. And you end up with things like this. See, these roads which are following township and range boundaries, this is in Michigan, Frankenmuth, Michigan, we've got a nice, beautiful straight road following the section boundaries. You can see this is a half section being formed here. We get up to the end, and whoops, no, we can't just continue straight on up the road because now we've got a correction factor, so we've had to move the next section over to account for the Earth's curvature. So we end up with a system that has lots of lumps, bumps, and bends in it. Here's what the Township and Range Survey system looks like fairly locally. Here's the system as it crosses from Los Angeles into Ventura County. And I'll just point out, I mean, it takes a little while to see them. Maybe it's easier with the mouse. Here's one of the correction lines where their last sections came up short. Okay, so they had to add some land onto each one to make it fit. Here's a case where they all went wrong, probably where it was crossing a river or a mountain chain. So they're all a little bit off, and they had to fudge by moving every single line within the system. And here, systematically, we've got a correction as we go from one set of townships to the next set of townships with a correction involved in it. So these are all on the map, all on the blanking on which principal meridian now, the first one I talked about. If we zoom in and look at, say, here's Ventura County, you can see that we've got townships and range sections divided off and numbered the way we would expect. If we go into the scale of, say, 1 to 24,000, like the topographic map that we're looking at for Yellow Rock around the Four Corners area, you'll notice that the range lines, the township and range lines from the U.S. Public Land Survey System are printed on the map. They're in red. In most cases, we're only going to see the sections. We're not going to see entire townships. Those only become visible when we go to about 1 to 100,000. And they're going to look something like this. They're going to be printed in red, and in the middle of each one is going to be its section number. So you can start figuring out from the section numbers and the way that the numbers on them flow which township and range you're in. Township and range numbers are also given to us on the periphery of the map, so we can read those off too. So again, township and range covers much of California, but California's history is a bit complex, so it needs to be taken into account. Okay, so Mexico and the U.S., California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Nevada, and parts of Wyoming, Colorado belonged to Mexico until 1836, and that was only after they'd split off from Spain and become separate. So we had a whole series of incidents, the Texas War, Manifest Destiny, the U.S.-Mexican War changed all of this, and then by treaty in 1848, Mexico ceded everything that's shaded there, half of Colorado, and the most of all the rest of those states, to the United States. So this was territory taken by force. In fact, one of the last battles was fought right here in Santa Barbara and involved an assault on the Presidio, right in town here, in which nobody was killed, I believe. Okay, so what do we have left in place in that entire territory? Well, we've got original Native American ownership rights, which they didn't have, obviously. Those were wiped out pretty much immediately. On top of that, we impose Spanish colonial land grants, in which huge tracts of property were given to usually royalty or individuals, often associated with missions. So Santa Barbara Mission was initially given enormous tracts of land in this region. Some of that land was sold off. When the land belonged to Mexico, trading patterns evolved again. Mexico began to impose some survey systems on it. Then it cedes to the United States. The U.S. would like to put the township and range system across everything, and indeed extends it over much of the state, but has to recognize all the existing ownership patterns. Okay, so what do you get? You get a hodgepodge. Here's Burbank. This is the cadastral map from part of Burbank, a rural orange growing area in 1911, and you can see that there are individual tracts where land's been divided up and given to farm workers, another completely different grid system, another completely different grid system, and then on top of that, the township and range system's been imposed over the top of the entire thing. So you can see that we've got this very complex pattern of land ownership, and in the end, it ends up almost being as bad as meets and bounds in some instances. So we've got the Spanish and the Mexican land grant tradition to deal with in much of the western United States, all the way down into Texas. And some of that land remained in the original holdings, like the Dos Pueblos holding, which was near us here, and the Santa Barbara Mission holdings, but others were divided up, and eventually cities were founded and land was sold off and chopped up. We have the remnants of another colonial system in the United States. This one, when the French settled the United States, which they originally did from the south up the Mississippi and from Canada through Quebec and Montreal and so on, they had a system which was entirely oriented towards trade by rivers. So the goal of the French occupation of North America was to get as much stuff trapped, shot, or mined out of the land and to quickly rush it down to a dock where it could be picked up by a boat and taken back to France. So it was an entirely extractive land ownership technique. It was only later when they started doing anything with the land, and most of the land was bottom land and not very good for agriculture anyway. So their pattern of land ownership said, let's give equal representation to everybody, so we'll give everybody access to the water. If we're going to give the maximum number of people access to the water, we'd better give the skinniest waterfronts you could. So they have these little skinny land parcels that go all the way back, and then they have odd shapes because the rivers meander around and they all converge in the middle of these patterns. You'll see these throughout Louisiana, throughout Quebec, even parts of northern U.S. Still attracted off in the French pattern on what are called longlots or longlot in the French. And these survive. They often have a road that's the first place you can drive. Here it's right up front, but often it's the first place you can not get flooded out, often called the River Road. Hundreds of thousands of roads in New England called the River Road that follow this parcel. So this land ownership pattern also imposed on the United States, but in other places like Louisiana. Another example, here's Colorado. So we're inside the formerly land-grant part of Colorado, because Colorado was split down the middle, diagonally, pretty much. And we've got previous existing grants. So here's Arroyo Seco grant to Jose Trujillo, given in 1707. And somebody's just drawn the section township boundaries right across the top anyway. So it's kind of like the same land exists, but now we're specifying it in a different way. So let's get really local now. This was all originally owned by the Santa Barbara Mission, the entire area here. It was later tracted out. One of the large land holdings was the Dos Pueblos Ranch, which still survives today. Still is much smaller than it used to be, but it still survived. Called Dos Pueblos because the first explorers saw two Chumash villages at the place and called it Two Villages. The land was bought up bit by bit. You notice that here's Goleta Beach and it says Moore's land here. We still talk about Moore Mesa, which is a little bit over here, but Moore also owned the land, part of the land that's now occupied by the campus. So people would buy bits of land all over the place, or more usually agree to take it in exchange for goods and services. Up here we have a big parcel of land now in an area called Glen Annie Ranch that was owned by W.W. Hollister, a very famous local guy. Don't get me started on Hollister, an amazing character. He drove a herd of sheep to California from Ohio and arrived just in time for the gold rush and managed to sell his entire bunch of sheep for a fortune. And invested all of that in land, and within very few years he owned, I wouldn't say half of California, but an enormous amount of land. There's a town called Hollister. But when he decided he got so much money, he wanted to retire. He ran for Senate. He was in government politics for a while. When he wanted to retire, he said, the most beautiful piece of California I've ever seen was in Goleta, in a place called, that I want to rename Glen Annie after my wife, Annie. So that's how Glen Annie got named. He moved his ranch here. He eventually lost that land in a lawsuit from some of the other local landowners. But I don't want to get into that story. Hollister Ranch, anybody that surfs knows Hollister Ranch, it's further out to the west. That's still land that we own. You notice here's an island, rather large island. That disappeared in World War II. They simply brought bulldozers in and filled it into the marshland behind it because they needed an airport and they needed it quickly. So that island disappeared, and there's only a little remnant of it left now behind the sewage plant. I've got to stop telling stories. I can go on all day. You notice here's Devereux Slough over here, and you notice these three land parcels. This is before it was owned by the Devereux. But at least the story is, and I'll repeat the Walter Tompkins story for local history, that Devereux Ranch used to be a famous spot where people came from all over the state to go to parties and have a good time. There were three people who were going to inherit property from the father onto the son, and one of them was I don't know what we call them today, mentally challenged, and the other two wanted to farm the land. So these two got these parcels, and this parcel was given to the son, who's mentally challenged, which turned out to be the site of the fourth largest oil field in the United States. So it made a fortune, which was then used to build the Devereux School. It's just been ceded to the university. The university just bought them out. Anyway, local stories. But I can think you can see that there, when you get local, there are lots of individual land holdings. You see that the edges of those boundaries are critical. There's the boundary between the Moors and the Hollisters. Becomes Hollister Avenue. It's the main street thoroughfare through Goleta even today, later to be followed by 101. Incidentally, I'll point out one more story. That railroad line was originally going all the way to San Francisco, and there was a lot of land speculation around it when it was being built. They ran out of money there on E. Cooper's land, but somebody had already sold a lot of land further down the coast and established a town called Naples. And they'd already sold about 100 land parcels all over the country. When the railroad didn't go that far, and there's still a depot road in Goleta there, by the way, the original depot that was there was moved and became the railroad museum in Goleta. They all lost their money, and that land parcel is only now coming up for sale, largely because of a really strange, long, and contorted legal process. Okay, property maps are extremely important. It's how we do the commerce of our nation. This is from the database that's established by the Santa Barbara County Assessor's Office. So it's the assessor's office in each county that has responsibility for land ownership and land parcels. Private surveying industry establishes the exact locations of the property boundaries. Those have now all been digitized and put into a database that the assessor's office uses to maintain it. You'll see that here's Goleta. This is Isla Vista. There's faculty housing over there. And so on, you can see the original ownership. Again, Isla Vista itself was a speculative venture. Somebody wanted to sell land by the seaside. There was no university then when it was all settled. They romantically named all the streets for artists and painters, thinking this would attract people to the seaside. Partitioned off the land so that most people had access to the sea. And you'll notice that if you look at the parcel map and put the air photo underneath, most of these parcels are now on the beach, and the cliff is about right up here, because it's all eroded away. So this is what an assessor's parcel database looks like. But the use of local cadastral maps with all their nitty-gritty and all their historical details becomes very important for land management. Okay, this is there's a sort of important history in this. This is from the Santa Barbara County Assessor's Office in 2001. When the first of the proposals were going through to establish Goleta as a separate independent town. Okay. Who was doing this? Well, something called the LAFCO, the Local Area Formation Committee, established by the state to manage the process by which cities are allowed to incorporate, establish themselves, and then take over surrounding territories. Okay. LAFCO was created in California because of this. See this little narrow strip coming in from the ocean? Not easy to walk along there, but eventually it comes across Goleta Beach, so we have a little bit of Goleta Beach, that's now the state beach. Then we have all of Goleta Slough and all the industrial land up to Hollister Avenue is all part of the city of Santa Barbara. Okay. what on earth is this? This on maps we call these land hooks, okay? Because they're just lines that arbitrarily connect other pieces of land. The city of Santa Barbara, I believe back in the 40s or 50s, decided that the airport was going to be part of Santa Barbara. So that's why we still call it Santa Barbara Airport. So they drew a line on the map from about Stearns Wharf, with about 100 meters wide, going out into the ocean. Then it takes a 90-degree bend, goes all the way over to Goleta, takes another 90-degree bend, and comes up onto Goleta Beach, and then the next is the airport. So the reaction to this, after all the political brouhaha had died down, was to form this committee that would oversee how cities get put together. You can see all these different neighborhoods labeled off in different colors. There were four attempts for Goleta to establish itself as a city, mostly because every time they tried to put the political bargain together, it all fell apart. Isla Vista was the big argument point. Lots of votes in Isla Vista, all you IV residents, and then there are all the people who live in Goleta that would rather have things governed and run a little bit differently. So the more conservative view prevailed. We got Isla Vista is still an unincorporated part of the county of Santa Barbara. We do have a city of Goleta now, which is largely the green area, as you see on this map. And we ended up with this sort of empty land in the middle that they now call Nolita, where it's not part of Santa Barbara, it's not part of Goleta. Okay, some other geographical units that we often deal with as far as land ownership is concerned. One set of units that is extremely important to us, whether we recognize it or not, are the census tracts. Now, what are the census tracts? Well, this is the way that the Bureau of the Census divides the country up so that it can send out enumerators to count all the people every 10 years. Okay, extremely important. They divide it into as small pieces as they can. Basically, the units are bigger where there are fewer things and smaller where there are more, so they can count more effectively. And the entire census is structured around basically whole city units, metropolitan areas, and then within them census tracts, and within which normally have up to about 5,000 people resident in them, and within those census block groups, and within those census blocks, which often are individual blocks, that are the units by which they collect their data. So in theory, and they don't release this data for a long time because it could reveal individuals' information, we can drill all the way down and have lots of information about where people live. Why? Well, because the U.S. Constitution says that every 10 years we recount the number of people in the country and reassign the congressional district boundaries so that they ensure equal representation for the people, so they have equal number of residents in them. When we recount the population, we just did that last April, the Census Bureau just did it, they're then going to redraw the congressional district's boundaries so that they reflect equal numbers of votes. California decided that they would do that independently by an independent commission rather than have the political parties fight it out. That was one of the things that's on our current ballot, is to repeal that piece of legislation. I'm not going to tell you how to vote because I wouldn't even begin to suggest that you should all probably vote no on that one. Okay, so this has population density shown. I just included that because Isla Vista has some of the highest population densities, people per square kilometer, anywhere west of the Mississippi River. It's a really unique place. So census tracts are important because they are the way by which we do congressional politics and voting. Neighborhoods are also important. Most people know the name of their neighborhood, or they know and describe areas by popular names. You know, so if you're in, everybody knows the Castro or the Mission District or Laurel Heights or the Presidio in San Francisco. And, there are popular names associated with, even with Isla Vista, People's Park and another park that I won't mention the name of. Then there are other districts which rule our lives, like school districts and voting districts and police districts and service delivery districts, water districts. And often these are sometimes coincident with things like municipal boundaries, sometimes coincident with other administrative boundaries, but they're never coincident with everybody else's boundaries. So we always run up against this problem of non-uniform delivery of services, and in this case, schooling. I was looking at this because I live over here, and look at this area. This is the other side of 101. It's in downtown Santa Barbara, but that's assigned to Monroe School, which is up here on the Mesa. It's kind of unusual. Maybe they just do one bus between the two or something. Or maybe there are no kids living downtown. It's hard to believe that. If you want to learn a little bit more about real estate, I'd recommend this website, www.zillow.com. And here I've zoomed in on Isla Vista, and we can see exactly what each, I'm sure some of you live in some of these buildings. You can not only see how much the owner paid for the property or what its current estimated value is. If you click in and see the details, you can see what the taxes are that are paid on that parcel, when the taxes were paid, what the year of sale of that parcel was, what the appreciation of the value has been in the last 10 years, and so on. Makes for interesting viewing. Anybody, when they first see Zillow for the first time, looks up their own house. Okay, so here's the summary of what I've gone on over today. And it's a little bit different in content. It's not so technical as the last lecture, but it is still very important indeed. So land partitioning systems, they're not like coordinate systems. Their goal is to divide the land up, usually for public ownership or for some other purpose, like taking a census or delivering a service like police or fire service. So they're used to describe areas on the Earth's surface, sometimes maybe even zip codes or something as simple as that. For cadastral systems, that's property ownership systems. Originally in this country, we had a system called meets and bounds, inherited from the British, but the founding fathers quickly reached back into the centuriation history of the ancient Romans to impose order on the West as we expanded West, and reinvented that system as the United States Public Land Survey System, or the USPLSS. So that was our standard, although I hope I've shown you today that it's not very standard. It's not nearly as standardized as some of the coordinate systems that we looked at last lecture. Okay, extremely important into the USPLSS are the principal meridians, the baselines, and how those were surveyed and laid out, how they were then divided up into townships and ranges, and how they were subdivided into sections and subsections that we used for land ownership. And then, of course, as that pattern, which is designed for a perfectly flat surface, meets the curvature of the Earth, we have to warp it and distort it and come up with corrections that reflect the reality of what we see on an everyday life. And then the last thing here, just as the ancient Romans decided when the Po Valley was just a mass of trees and they needed to feed the citizens of Rome, the whole thing was going to go under the axe and the plow, they needed some way of doing that logically. That grid imposed on the Po Valley is still there today, 3,000, 2,000, 2,500 years later, still there. Okay? The system they tried to impose on parts of North Africa, the Romans did, is still there, still evident in the land ownership patterns. So as we've divided up this country in much the same way, there's all the evidence of these different patterns, and it's become the basis, the kind of framework around which we hang the geography of the country. Okay, so it has an impact on the human landscape and the way we all live our lives. All right, so have a good weekend. I'll see you on Monday.